how do you differentiate, in your view, between unfair manipulation and, you know, I guess, ethical marketing?
The line between influence and manipulation is super unclear.
If people want to try and reduce, if this is possible, the extent to which they are manipulated,
there are things that can be done, although they're relatively limited.
Is this something that comes up every day then, and just the way you interact with people in your life?
If you can understand why people behave differently than you, and you see it as a behavioral science problem, then it also gives you the opportunity to engage in kind of productive conversations, and also it stops you from being angry all the time.
What do you think it means to live a good life?
I really like being a scientist and getting to try to contribute maybe just a little bit to the sort of overall knowledge in the world.
Welcome back to the Human Podcast, where I delve into the minds of a wide range of individuals by asking about their lives, careers, and ideas. If you enjoy the show, please consider hitting the subscribe button below.
Okay, so I'm joined today by Joe Devlin, who's a professor of cognitive neuroscience at UCL here in London. And he's also the co-founder and head of neuroscience at the Applied Consumer Neuroscience Lab. Joe, thanks for speaking today. It's great to have you here.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Joe.
So you're a leading researcher on consumer neuroscience. I just want to ask, first of all, like, what are some of the kind of key ways that you think businesses utilize their knowledge of like how we behave and how we think to drive and like influence sales and how we consume?
It's a really interesting question because it happens in lots of different levels. It happens very informally. So I think a ton of people in marketing have really good intuitions about behavior and psychology, even if they maybe don't have any formal training in it. And as a result, they sort of notice things and use it effectively. So a couple of years ago, I was talking to the founder of Camden Hells, right? The local beer company that's been really successful. And what was fascinating is he's a man who loves beer, but his intuitions about marketing and the things that are effective, so the color red and its role in grabbing attention, the emphasis that he has on freshness and making sure that the beers are distributed in a way that people are getting high quality every time, but that limits their reach, right? They can't send them easily to Edinburgh because they don't arrive fresh enough. So there are all these kind of things that he has particularly good intuitions on that were, I think, very important in making Camden Hell such a successful beer. So you range from people on that side of things to companies like Coca-Cola or Apple with perhaps much deeper pockets who want to use sort of neuromarketing, consumer neuroscience approaches where they're paying for brain scans or whatever the case may be to try to understand their consumers better and use that information to either improve their products or to improve their campaigns. I think there's less of that because mostly it's been super expensive and some examples have been sort of high profile failures, but there's a real range and everything in between is available to companies as well.
On like a typical day, let's take someone kind of hanging out, walking around London. Would you kind of say that they are like targeted to like a much higher extent than they're probably aware of?
I think there are probably a lot of things that are targeted in general, but maybe not sort of at them in particular. So for instance, a really good example that's really prevalent in UK grocery stores and less so in the US, for instance, is that a lot of grocery stores put their bakery by the front door. And the reason they do that is because everybody already knows that when you're hungry, you actually buy more when you go to the grocery store. And one of the ways of getting people hungry is the smell of baking bread, right? So literally when you walk into a grocery store and you're sort of overwhelmed by the smells coming out of the bakery, which almost uniformly people think are pretty good, it's a little behavioral nudge. It changes that sort of appetite level in you and you're more likely to spend more during your shop than you would otherwise. And I think things like that are targeted at consumers in a very broad sense. They're not like aimed at me, they're not aimed at you, but they're nonetheless affecting all of us as we go through our daily lives. There are micro-targeting approaches as well that are much more specifically aimed at individuals. And most of that is less neuro and more sort of big data. So the fact that, you know, Apple and Google know quite a lot about our digital behavior because you're wearing, carrying, whatever their devices, and they can track your online behavior, and they can do that and identify you because you're logged into your accounts. They can then use that information to, you know, target particular advertisements to us that are you know, based on your interests or my interests, based on our search history, et cetera. And that kind of micro-targeting is certainly very prevalent, but I don't think it makes a big difference as you walk around in your daily life. I think it's much more on your sort of online presence.
You mentioned two companies like Google and Apple. I feel like these are obviously two of the big ones people are kind of most loyal to. This idea of brand loyalty, like what are some of the tactics like brands like this have employed over time to get someone to be very loyal and committed to them as like a company?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, the relationship we have with brands, because in many ways we treat brands a bit like people. So for products and services, it's just a thing. Whereas brands, you kind of have a relationship with. And the only other things you have relationships with tend to be people and or pets. So there's a whole bunch of things that brands can do to leverage those kind of relationship aspects. And to some extent, they do it well, and sometimes they get it wrong as well. So part of it is reciprocity. So one of the things that's important, particularly among friends, but family, et cetera, is that you have this reciprocal arrangements. When somebody needs a hand, you offer it to a friend, and you probably don't think twice about it. And as a result, when you need a hand at some sort, you would expect that from your friend as well. And it's not a quid pro quo. It's not like, I gave you this, you've got to give me something back. That's more sort of a Venmo going out to the pub kind of approach. And brands can use that too. I mean, they try to provide loyalty programs in particular where, you know, you go to your favorite coffee shop 7 times and the 8th time you get a coffee. So you're rewarded for your loyalty and you see that as a benefit. Grocery stores use it with their loyalty card schemes. But that's slightly different in the sense that, yes, you get loyalty card pricing and therefore there's a financial benefit to it and you build up points. But they're also using that data to understand your behavior and other consumers and target advertising and things. So there's a slightly hidden aspect to that for most consumers. I don't think many people think about that stuff. So reciprocal arrangements, but trust is another big one. So for instance, Facebook, when it was bigger, a few years ago in the UK and the US, did a number of things that I think people felt violated their trust. They started running large-scale experiments on people that only came out very much after the fact. And it was one of the things that really started limiting people's interest in using Facebook to help them move to newer forms of social media. And that's a sort of a brand loyalty thing, right? As soon as you do that, then consumers think, wait a second, I thought that we had a decent arrangement and that everything was okay. And I'm a little bit upset to discover that you are monetizing my data in a way that I had no idea. And in fact, it's being used against me. So reciprocity, trust are two of the big ones. And reputation is big. You know, if you have a reputation for being a good player and treating people fairly and doing things right, then that makes a big difference because it attracts customers who have an interest in that kind of a relationship. And the more they see that reinforced, the more likely they are to sort of stick around and be loyal customers.
This kind of idea that consumerism is like the kind of biggest and newest, you know, new religion. It's something that we worship. What do you make of that kind of statement when people say it?
I guess it's kind of implicit in the sort of massive data scale that's now such a, you know, an important part of the economy. I've heard people say that data is the new oil, right? I don't know if that's true. I don't work specifically in big data, but it's amazing. The computational power that has just gone up in exponentially over the last maybe 30 years has enabled companies to collect this kind of data and store it, but also process it, right? And you see that with the increase in sort of data science jobs in a big way, but also in the sort of machine learning AI field where, sure, if our data scientists aren't up to it, maybe the AI is better able to extract some of these patterns and understand consumer behavior and maybe get incremental advantages in terms of selling our products, brand, marketing, whatever the case may be. So I think it's true. I mean, there's a lot of business interest in understanding consumers and monetizing their data as best possible. I'm not sure it's as true for consumers. Like, I think most of us are kind of just going about our day normally. And most people don't seem to even think about the data that they're sharing on a regular basis, which I personally find mildly terrifying. But my children, who are both grown up at this point, tell me I'm just a big old dinosaur at this point and that I should get over it.
That's interesting. Do you take any kind of precautions, you think, that the average person doesn't then, to kind of, you know, safeguard your data?
I do. Yeah. So I don't use any of those big corporate products. And I do use things like Signal and DuckDuckGo as a search engine rather than Google as a search engine, and Brave as a browser rather than Chrome. So I make a concerted effort to limit my digital footprint, mostly because I sort of object to being monitored to that extent. One of the arguments I always hear is, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, what difference does it make, right? And I am, you know, I appreciate that argument, and I think most people aren't doing anything wrong and don't think anything of it. But I'm also sensitive to the fact that sometimes just being becomes wrong, right? And there are groups throughout the world where this is the case. If you look at Uyghurs in China, I suppose the vast majority of the Uyghurs aren't doing anything that's anti, you know, government, but they belong to a group that used to be okay and is now persecuted. And the amount of surveillance and things that happen with them is problematic. And you know, there are examples like that throughout history. And I worry, for instance, that in the US, there's a possibility that we go a bit Handmaid's Tale, depending on the outcome of elections over the next few years. And it's the same issue. If the data's there and you weren't doing anything wrong, but suddenly your existence is wrong, you're in trouble.
So with advertising and companies, you know, trying to develop brand loyalty, how do you differentiate, in your view, between kind of unfair manipulation, too much kind of hacking of our brains and our psychology, and, you know, I guess, ethical marketing? What's the kind of distinction you make there?
Yeah, I think this is such an important area. The line between influence and manipulation is super unclear. And I think that all advertising, PR, and marketing is designed to influence your behavior. Even if it's something really simple, like if you didn't know about our product and now you do, you might use it, right? And I think most of us would agree that that's not manipulation. That's sharing information. Mm-hmm. And if we don't know about it, guaranteed we're not going to use the product. However, most marketing, I would say, is designed to do more than that. They're designed to try to make the product appealing, at least have you try it. And of course, if it's a good product or service that's valuable to you, then again, that doesn't feel manipulative. It feels like they've allowed you to maintain your autonomy. You've made a decision that's appropriate for you. It's when you cross that. It's when you start doing things that maybe the person's not aware of, and therefore it's influencing them, but in a way that they wouldn't have thought of, that becomes gray to bad. So for instance, there's a neat study about 10 years ago that looked at moral decision-making. So this is just an academic paper by Daniel Richardson and his group, and he did it using eye tracking. At the time, you needed to have fancy eye tracking equipment. But what they did was they would ask people morally ambiguous questions like, is it ever under any circumstance okay to kill another human being? And of course, you can argue back and forth, well, if you're defending your family, you know, that's one thing that's very different than if you're taking someone's wallet, right? And what's interesting is they just had yes and no on the screen. And what they did was they tracked people's eyes. And when the when their eyes were on one or the other, based on the eye tracking, you then said, make a decision. People were 10 to 12% more likely to decide whatever they were looking at that moment. And to me, that's a super interesting study because, one, it tells you something about how eye movements reflect kind of the cognitive processes that are going on, but it has the potential to be deeply manipulative, right? Because nowadays, the camera on your laptop, on your phone, is more than capable of doing that level of eye tracking. Now, I'm not aware that any company is actually doing this. However, if you just simply were able to do eye tracking through the phone or laptop, Then what you could do is, as you're on an e-commerce site and somebody's maybe, you notice that their eyes are spending a little bit of time on something that's unusual, you might then use that to sort of say, pop up a little, hey, and if you do it right now, you get 10% off. And of course, the person who's looking at it thinks, oh, that was lucky. But it isn't lucky. They're using information that you're not even aware that you're sharing to try to manipulate your, you know, purchase decisions at that point. And to me, that's at least gray, if not unethical, because the person's autonomy is interfered with. They aren't given all the information to make an informed decision. If you popped up that and said, hey, I can see that you're looking at this, and if you'd like to make the purchase, now you can get an extra 10% off, I kind of feel like that's a little bit clearer on the ethical side, because you've given people some information about why you're giving them this discount, and they can then decide or not to, you know, to yes or no with it. So for me, it's anything that starts to infringe on people's ability to make their decisions without being unfairly targeted, in the sense that they don't have all the information that's being used against them.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about this eye tracking example before. Is this being used currently by companies? And if so, like to a very large extent already, companies like Amazon and typical shopping sites?
I'm not aware that anybody is using this particular version of it. There are on a lot of out of home, so on billboards. Now a lot of digital billboards have cameras. And I think that most people probably have never noticed that. But it's interesting because as you walk by the billboard and look at it, it's looking at you too. And the advantage to that is it can do things, they normally do things that are a little bit cruder, like if you're facing the billboard as opposed to just walking by, then it tracks the fact that whatever it is playing at this point, and you know, if it's me, it's a sort of a middle-aged white guy, and they can feed that sort of information back to the advertisers, whatever it was that happened to be playing, and say, look, this is something about the demographics or the people who are paying attention to what's going on. So that's monitoring more than manipulating. And of course, that's data that's potentially useful to the client whose advertising is on the screens. But no, I'm not aware of anybody currently doing that. I'd love to know whether anyone is, because the tech has been available for at least 10 years.
Yeah. But this billboard kind of technology is being used right now in cities like London. And
it started out at the airport, City Airport in London.
When was that, when it started?
Oh, that's a good question. Maybe 2015?
Yeah. Okay. Well,
So it's
a decade.
It's been around. Yeah. And part of it was, in the airport, they wanted to send you to specific shops, right? So there are things that I'm likely to go to as a shop that my wife would be different. You know, she'd go to something maybe about clothes or bags or something, and I might go to an electronic shop or something. Hmm. And all it has to do is see that primarily what's passing at the moment are guys, and the right ads to have up are more the digital shops or whatever. So some of that is designed to try to get you the information that they think you want. Some of that is designed to be a little bit on the manipulative side in my mind. And people vary, again, because I've had people say, yeah, but I'd rather see the information that I'm interested in. Hmm. And I get that. That makes sense. And I have other people say, hey, how do you know what I'm interested in? I might be trying to get a gift for my wife, in which case that's not helpful to me at all. So it cuts both ways, but I think on average, the corporate side is to think, well, we can make reasonable assumptions about the demographics that we're looking at and use that to target the advertising.
Mm. So, I mean, coming back to this point about distinguishing like fair and unfair manipulation, it does obviously sound like an incredibly difficult, it's hard to answer this question. Obviously, you've given a great example where it seems a bit too far if someone's tracking your eyes. But if you're trying to kind of condense it into this a kind of moral rule of, you know, if we do this, this is fair, and if this isn't, is there a way you can bring that together? It sounds like the tensions maybe between, as you say, some people argue, well, if it brings me great value, then I'm okay with that. And some people don't want things to happen to them that they're not aware of. So like, if you can kind of try and condense it down into a moral rule, what would you say it comes down to? If you do this, it's okay. And if you do this, it isn't. Can you do that? Or is it quite tricky to...
No, I think that's a really important question. And I think of it in terms of there are certain principles that give you clear guidelines to being on an ethical or unethical side. I think that if you're using people's data or you're doing some sort of neurobehavioral manipulative kind of thing, are people aware of it? Do they have they been informed of this and consented to the use of their data in this way? And I think that that's one big aspect. I should come back to that, because one thing that some companies will say is, well, they signed the end user license agreement that clearly said what we were doing. And you think, right, yeah, but nobody's ever read one of those as far as I can tell. I'm not sure that's really that ethical. Yeah.
And if they have, they've not understood it or forgotten it or whatever, right?
Like, well, that's the other thing, right? Yeah. So informed consent's one. I think that anything that's interfering with autonomous decision-making, I think that falls into manipulation. I think you have to be clear about how the data are being used and how they're being stored and maintained. So for instance, if I've agreed to provide certain amounts of data, I want to know that it's for the uses that you've actually told me and that you're not actually doing, that's the tip of the iceberg, and actually you're using it for lots of other things that may not make me very comfortable, or you're selling it on to other, you know, companies for their use. So how are the data being used, stored, and maintained, whether they're being sold on? I think that that's an important part of it. I actually think that it has to be scientifically valid, whatever they're doing. So for instance, the eye tracking example is based on some good science. However, there's lots of misuses of data that aren't intentional, but they're nonetheless misuses. So for instance, one of the big banks in the UK started doing this thing that for their graduate training program, they would they'd wire up their applicants to an EEG headset, so an electroencephalography, which is a way of recording brain waves through these nets of sensors on your skull. Hmm. So they clearly knew they were doing this. They provided informed consent in the sense that they wanted this job, but then they would measure this brainwave activity and say, oh, okay, well, based on this activity, you'd be better in a sort of accounting role, or you might be better in HR or marketing or whatever. I don't think there's very good data to suggest that that's true. And I'd be very curious to know what they've done to avoid discrimination and bias. So typically, a lot of these experiments, when we run them at universities, are run with, you know, 18 to 25 year olds who frankly tend to be white and educated and rich, or at least upper middle class. And all of that's not necessarily problematic by itself. But if that's your baseline, then are you discriminating against anyone who just doesn't fit that category? And you might be doing that without even knowing it, right? So things like that are important aspects of, there has to be good scientific validity, and that validity has to ensure that it's doing its absolute best to avoid discrimination, you know, as well. So I think those kind of things are the principles that help people and companies stay on the bright side of ethical neuromarketing, neurotech. And if you're questionable about any of those, then I think it's worth sort of reviewing the practice to say, is there a way of doing it ethically that doesn't necessarily interfere with anything, but empowers your consumers in a better way?
If people want to try and reduce, if this is possible, the extent to which they are manipulated, is there any steps, is there any actions that you can advise they kind of take?
There are things that can be done, although they're relatively limited, right? One of the big ones is to just be more informed about how your data are being used and how groups can manipulate you. So one of the really common manipulations in sales is something called an anchoring effect. This is just a straight behavioral nudge bias that we do all the time, which is that if you see a number, it biases your perception towards that number. So the classic scientific example of this is you just ask people, like, when Gandhi died, was he older or younger than 130? And almost everybody's like, he was younger than 130, because not too many people make it to 130. And then you say, well, how old was he, right? And people on average come up with about 77, right? But if you ask the question the other way and you say, well, was Gandhi older or younger than 30 when he died? And again, people probably recognize he was older than that. Mm-hmm. But now they'll say that he died when he was about in the mid-50s. Right. So what you've done is you've anchored people's perception of what the true number is to this completely irrelevant and obviously irrelevant piece of information, right? That 130 or 30. Mm. It turns out he was in his 60s when he died. So you make a big difference to those estimates, like 20 years, right? But sales does this all the time. When you see a sale and you say, like, reduced from, you know, 1895 to 1295, well, whether it ever was 1895 or not, this now seems like a bargain because it's a third off, half off, you know, whatever. And you see these things all the time. And the truth of the matter is, we're all affected by it. But if you recognize what it's doing, you say, oh, right, that's just the anchoring bias, and I can appreciate that that's what's happening here, then you're more likely to be less influenced, right? So one thing that people can do is just sort of become more aware of the sort of day-to-day manipulations that exist. Most of them are relatively benign. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the 70s, when people started putting product placements into films, people were outraged, right? Like, you're saying that the fact that there's that can of soda in, I don't know, the James Bond film, it's probably not in Bond, it would be beer or something, is actually influencing my decision to go out and buy that. And partly they were outraged because they just had never heard that that could make a difference. Nowadays, even little kids recognize product placement, and it has less of an effect. It's not zero, but it's less, just simply because people are aware.
And kind of going back to the some of those examples you talked about a minute ago, eye tracking and so on, you gave this really interesting talk titled Ethics for Our Brave New World. I guess you're looking at some of your worries around where this is going to go in the future, especially as kind of more invasive technologies are brought online. Can you talk about some of your concerns of the higher degrees of manipulation we may see in the future when we get more advanced technology coming out?
Well, I think, I mean, a really good example is the idea of lie detection. So obviously we know that not everybody's honest all the time, and sometimes it's unintentional, but sometimes it's intentional. So, you know, you see this if you're a police officer and you're a detective or something and you're trying to deal with crimes, right? And you're interviewing witnesses. Some of what you get isn't correct, and some of that's because somebody's intentionally telling you things that aren't true. Wouldn't it be nice to have tech that would allow you to know if somebody's not telling the truth? And lie detection has a long and glorious history of different ways of trying to measure it. And of course, people know about like lie detectors or polygraph machines, but sometimes people aren't aware that they're not considered legal evidence in UK or US courts, for instance, because they're relatively easy to beat. If you know how it works, I can tell you how to beat it in 2 minutes. And they don't always give the right answers anyway. But what's happened is there's been this idea that, well, okay, maybe 1950s lie detectors don't work, but what about all the more modern neuroscience? And brain scanning techniques should be able to tell lies from not lies, right? And there have been efforts to do that. In the US, there's a company called No Lie fMRI that was offering their services to legal cases where they would say, you could come and get a brain scan, and based on your brain scan, we'll tell whether or not the person is telling the truth or not. And it fits your intuition that, well, they've got to know, right? It's in their brain. And if it's a brain scan, surely you should be able to figure this out. The truth of the matter is the science doesn't exist. I mean, we don't know how to tell lies from not lies using a brain scan. And again, that's not legal in the US at this point. But in India, there's an approach that's been using EEG to try to detect lies from non-lies, truth. And there's a woman named Aditi Sharma who is serving a life prison sentence for killing her ex-fiance based almost entirely on this brain scan that was used. In the decision, the judge spent 9 pages of her decision saying, I really wouldn't have believed that this young sort of upper middle class woman who seems very shy and meek and nice would in cold blood kill her ex-fiance. But the data from the brain scan was so compelling that I've had to agree that she's guilty and, you know, she's serving a life sentence. And to me, that's like seriously Minority Report crazy stuff, right? The science does not exist to do that. So the fact that they managed to convince a judge, in some sense, isn't shocking because who's going to know the ins and outs of the neuroscience well enough? I mean, she's a legal professional. That's not her field. But nonetheless, they were able to my mind, I would say, bamboozle this poor judge and others in the legal profession. Now, in fairness, they probably believe that their science does work. It's just that it really hasn't been validated by the rest of the scientific community. And I would say the vast majority of the people I've spoken to in the field have grave concerns about the validity of this kind of an approach. And if you're going to literally put someone to jail for life, I'd like to know that this not only works, but it's super sensitive and it's very specific and that it's really beyond reproach. And there's no question it is not at this point.
Okay, and you co-founded the Applied Consumer Neuroscience Lab. Can you tell us a bit about the work and what you're up to that?
Yeah, it was interesting because I didn't really intend to do this. For years, I worked at the MRI Center at UCL in Birkbeck, and I was one of the directors. And we had a lot of sort of approaches from different companies who wanted to just do stuff with MRI. So we got asked, for instance, can we prove that pudding makes your brain happy using the scanner? Could we show fear in the scanner by putting someone in there and putting a live tiger in there? And we got all sorts of great approaches, most of which were completely out there as far as I was concerned. But what changed my perspective on this was there was an advertising agency called JWT in town who got in touch and said, hey, we're running this conference for planners and advertising. Advertisers have seen pretty much everything. Could we do something where we, you know, scan the brains of some of our speakers and use the imagery to advertise the conference? I was like, oh yeah, of course, we could definitely do that. That's well within the sort of technology and an ethical use and all the rest. And for me, I said, sure, and started working with JWT and realized these were some incredibly smart people who were really genuinely interested in how you could use brain science in a legitimate way. But they knew there was a lot of hype and misinformation out there. And they just didn't know how to find what was legit and what wasn't. And I thought, well, as somebody who works in higher education, that's kind of what I do, right? Education is my thing. And I don't have a vested interest. I'm not trying to sell any of it. I'm much more interested in people using it in a productive way. So the people at JWT were the ones who actually convinced me there was a genuine market for good ethical neuroscience being applied more widely. And we started by just running workshops, like how do you find this information? How do you tell good from bad? What are the ranges of things that you can do and how accessible would it be? Like what would it take to actually get involved in different types of projects? And that was really fun. But what happened was that some of these people who came to our workshops came back afterwards and said, hey, we were thinking about this and we'd like to do an experiment along these lines. Would it be possible to do something with you? And at that point, we thought, oh, yeah, no, that would be really fun. And that's when we created this little agency to run these kind of bespoke research projects with various groups. And over the years, it's been an immense pleasure. It's a sort of a side gig because obviously I still have my job at UCL, but it means that we get our students involved and they get some experience working with the corporate world and trying to see how some of the skills that we teach them might be applied in the real world. And we get to work with these great companies who are interested in doing things, to my mind, the right way. And it's just been win-win-win as far as I'm concerned. So it's a side thing, but it's been immensely fun and it continues to be fun.
So it'd be great to get a little bit into your kind of story now. So you actually started off doing a PhD in artificial intelligence. I'm just intrigued, like given what's kind of going on, particularly in the last few years, do you ever regret not having continued in that discipline?
You know what? I would, if you had asked me that 2 years ago, I'd have said, no, I'm super happy. And now I do. I absolutely have reservations about the fact that I gave up on it too early. So I did my PhD in the 90s, right? So this was last millennium. And AI at the time was pretty crude. So I actually was doing work on the sort of precursors to deep learning. I was using artificial neural nets, and I thought that was very, very interesting. But the artificial was just too much for me at the time. And I thought, man, I better learn something about actual intelligence, and then hopefully I can bring it back to the AI field later. And then after 25 years in neuroscience, I just sort of joke and say, well, Clearly, that's not happening. I'm not going back to AI. But what I feel like is AI came back to me because all the things that I was really interested in, which mostly were around the ability of AI to speak with us, to communicate in natural language, they were there as soon as ChatGPT became available. And I think one of the brilliant moves that OpenAI made was making that sort of freely available for people to try it. So you'd heard all the hype, but no, you could actually see, did it, you know, what could it do? And yes, it could make, you know, songs in the style of Taylor Swift for your latest breakup, and it could do it in haiku form and all these kind of crazy things. But it was astonishing, and it really got me very much interested in AI again. So for the last year and a half, I've spent quite a considerable amount of my time trying to read up on what I've missed in the intervening 25 years and get a better understanding of the architectures and what they can do and what they can't and why and how that relates to the neuroscience that I do. So for me, hearing people like Ilya Sutskever, I'm not pronouncing his name right and I'm sorry, or Jeff Hinton or others say, look, AGI, artificial general intelligence, we're on the doorstep of that. Artificial superintelligence, we are probably not that far away. I mean, according to Ilya, he says we're going to have it in the next 10 years. I think that we have specific examples of it, like AlphaGo, you know, from DeepMind, but not general artificial superintelligence yet. And if that's true, that's the stuff that got me excited about being in AI to begin with when I was, you know, 21 or something. And to think that that's happening now is immensely exciting. I'm looking for ways to try to combine some of the neuroscience that I'm interested in, general intelligence as relates to, you know, human behavior, with some of these new AI models to try to get a better understanding of where they're similar, where they're different, and how that changes the way we think of our own intelligence and how that affects the development of, you know, artificial intelligence. So super interesting time.
Are you considering at all being able to shift any of your work into this area? Is there a way to do this at all or not?
I think there must be a way to do it. And I haven't quite figured out what it is. I mean, one of the things that I am particularly interested in at the moment and I'm starting to work on is the idea of using these kind of large language models to do agent-based modeling. So the idea, agents or an agentic AI is like a big phrase at the moment, right? And I think that mostly what people are thinking about is something to handle my emails or my calendar or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely one type of agent. But I was thinking about it slightly differently. I was thinking about more generating almost a sort of AI-based sims. Like if you could create small little virtual worlds that are based on AI agents that sort of autonomously interact within this virtual environment, then you could use that to, for instance, model consumer behavior. So for instance, you could just sort of say, you know, let's just say you create a little town where you have a population of people who are doing their normal daily lives. And these kind of things already exist. It's not particularly difficult. But what if you were to then start introducing advertising campaigns? Like, so one of the things that we've been playing with, not for any particular reason, but it just seemed like a good idea, was like looking at beer consumption. So in this little town called Smallville that there's already code for, there's a pub, but there's also a grocery store and people can, and they have refrigerators so that they can go and do things, socialize at the pub, et cetera. Well, you can just measure like beer consumption in this town over a week just by sort of monitoring the code. And what if you then said to this environment, well, the World Cup's on. So it's not even a marketing change. It's just the environment's changed. And the LLMs, they have this kind of world knowledge built into them. They already do change their behavior according to context. And you don't have to specifically build in that information. And you sort of say, well, does that change the amount of beer that's consumed during the course of the World Cup? And if it does, and this is exactly what we're sort of playing with at the moment, then that's really interesting because it starts to provide a little sense that you might be able to make some valid inferences by looking at this kind of almost Truman Show of an AI-based world and trying to look at how different types of campaigns or interactions might influence behavior and then try to scale it up to particular markets.
How have AI systems that have come out in the last few years perhaps changed your your thoughts around how human intelligence might work? Has there been anything there?
Well, that I think is one of the things that I'm really interested in. So I spent 20 years of my career thinking about how language works in the brain and why we have language and some of our closest cousins like chimps and bonobos and gorillas don't. Like our brains are remarkably similar. What is different here? And despite all of that time in academia, I don't think I've ever heard anyone genuinely suggest that the way we produce language might be by predicting the next word, right? Which is essentially what encoder-decoder models are doing. But I would say, I think it's a remarkably good model for how we actually speak. And you can see that just based on the output. Now, there's issues about how they're trained and the data and things like that. But the fact that they can produce language at the level that they do and the way they can understand language, which you can argue about how much they understand and how much maybe we understand. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it works, right? That's super cool to me because it made me rethink the way I think humans are actually producing language. And I genuinely think that in the language context, I think that that predictive model is probably a very good understanding for how we work. In contrast, one of the things that's hot in AI and in the business world is attention. They mean attention in a completely different way when they talk about attention in AI models, you know, with these sort of attentional heads and things like that. There's some correspondences, but I think it's fundamentally a different concept. I don't think attention in AI tells us anything about the way humans attend to information, other than they share the idea that in both cases, there's limited information processing capacity that needs to be focused in on certain aspects of the data stream, right? And I think that's true in both cases, but the way it actually works is completely different. So what's fascinating to me is, well, where are they similar? And when they're similar between AIs and people, is that because they're doing things the same way or have they solved the problem in a fundamentally different way? And where they're different, does that mean that the AI could not be there? Or is it if it had sort of maybe better algorithms or more tuned towards the kind of things that we think of as intelligent behavior, then maybe you'll get significant increases and move closer to artificial general intelligence.
Hmm. Yeah, talking about the kind of similarities or differences, it was interesting because DeepMind released like their own podcast episode the other day where Demis is interviewed by Hannah Fry, a mathematician. And yeah, he basically just admits that they seem to be taking significantly less inspiration at the moment from some areas of neuroscience because they've worked out they can do things from in kind of such radically different ways than maybe humans can, next word prediction and so on. So that was kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, I agree. And it's really interesting because Demis has a PhD in neuroscience in addition to all of his, you know, AI credentials. So he's a fascinating character. And they have neuroscientists at DeepMind. People like Matt Botvinnik are, you know, neuroscientists. It's really interesting, right? Because there are lots of ways to solve problems. And the classic is how we fly in planes versus birds. But I think sometimes what gets thrown out with that is, well, wings and jet engines are very different different things. That's true. You know, planes don't flap. However, the aerodynamics of the wing is fundamentally the same. They took the principles and they applied them in different ways. And I think that we're seeing some of that in like Google DeepMind and in some of the others, Anthropic and OpenAI and others, where they're sort of saying, reasoning is the hot topic at the moment. Most of us like to think that we're intelligent because we can reason, we can plan. And it's an important part of being intelligent. I'm not sure that it's the be-all end-all to our intelligence. But all of them are searching, you know, at the moment for the Q-star strawberry algorithm that's going to give them reasoning capabilities. And in fact, I think there was an announcement maybe 2 days ago from OpenAI in Japan suggesting that they're going to release that this year. Hmm. And I think from what I understand of the Q-star algorithm, it doesn't do reasoning the way we do reasoning. That doesn't mean that it doesn't give you good results. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't really know what kind of results it gets. But the story is that it's going to be very impressive. And given their recent track record, I certainly wouldn't put it past them. But I think that what's happened is that they found other ways of using the same principles about the way we reason to that work well in the sort of silica that they have and the algorithms that they have. And that may be a different approach, a different type of intelligence than ours, even if it converges in terms of what it can do. And that's super cool, right? Mm-hmm.
As much as I'd love to keep asking you questions about AI, we must move on a couple of final things. So yeah, between your PhD in AI and all the kind of consumer neuroscience work that we've spent time speaking about this episode, am I right that your kind of other key research focus was on how the brain processes language? Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yeah, so I was always interested in language, possibly because I only have one, and I'm very jealous of those people who can speak multiple languages, just for the ability to interact with so many other people and cultures. It's amazing. And I have a ton of respect for anybody who can do that. So it's a, you know, I'm terminally an English speaker. But I was always curious about, like, why we have it, why does it exist, and why don't other species have it? And that's sort of a loaded question in the sense that, you know, one of the things you hear is that humans have language and other species don't. I think that that's a little bit glib. The more I looked into it, the more it became apparent that there are a lot of aspects of language that we have that other species also have. What they don't seem to have is all of the pieces put together in the way that we do. And I became really fascinated by, you know, I mean, language is essentially words that represent ideas in the world that are combined together in a sort of structured way so that you can essentially do mind reading and I can do mind reading. When you're talking, I can sort of read what's in your mind because you're giving me that clue through language and vice versa. But, you know, if you look, there are things like meerkats and spider monkeys have different calls for different predators. So the things that they worry about are things like snakes, eagles, and cougars. I think it's cougars, but some sort of big cat on the ground, right? And it's important that if you're gonna make a predator call and it's a snake, going up into a tree is probably a reasonably good idea if you're quick, right? But if it's an eagle, that's a really bad idea, right? So the way they escape is very much relevant. And this is not innate. They have to learn these. And these are very much like the way we learn words. Now, there's only three words in that case, and little kids quickly have more than that. But they clearly have the idea of words, right? And songbirds, kind of the opposite. They don't seem to have the idea of words, but they very much have the idea of syntax and how to put song elements together into stretches that work coherently. And if you mess that up, the syntax of the song, birds don't like it. So they have the ability to construct these, you know, sequences that we do, but they don't have words. The monkeys have the words, they don't have a way to construct these sequences. Some of the great apes can do both, but not very well. I mean, they don't have the vocal cords to make the sounds that we do. But if you teach them to sign, they can be productive. They can learn 1,000, 2,000 words, and they can put them together. So the classic example was, I think it was Coco, Washoe's, no, it was Washoe. It was one of these chimps that had been trained with American Sign Language, and they took Washoe out to a park one day, and he saw ducks for the first time. He had never seen a duck before, and it was on the pond. And he pointed at it and then signed waterbird, right? Which he didn't have a sign for duck, and that's a perfectly appropriate thing, and it's just what a little kid would do. Mm-hmm. And then you think, okay, well, that's clearly, there's some of the language stuff is there. Why can't they put it together and do what we do? So that's what got me into it. And I was really fascinated by that. And it was, the question is like, well, it's got to be down to some hardware aspects in our brain. What would they be? And I spent 20, 25 years looking into different possibilities there. Ultimately, I don't think we've solved the problem, but I think that all of the evidence points to the idea that the basic structures in our brain, in terms of the regions and how they're laid out, are very much almost exactly identical to chimps and gorillas and bonobos and things. But some of the wiring patterns that link those areas up are different. And that's the kind of thing that's actually under relatively tight genetic control. So those wiring patterns get laid down in utero based on chemical gradients that are controlled by genes. So all you need to do is change a gene a little bit, and maybe you make it act for, you know, an extra 8 hours, and all of a sudden you're not connecting A to B, but you're connecting A to C because the connection's just gone by B and gone over to C. And the nature of the wiring patterns changes the nature of the information processing. And my best guess at the moment is that that's what's actually happened. There have been a few of these relatively subtle changes to our basic wiring that are slightly different than some of our cousins, but have enabled us to link regions together that wouldn't otherwise. And that's allowed us to use language when they can't as yet.
Do you have much insight into what drives your fascination with the human mind, intelligence, AI, and so on?
Well, when I was a kid, I loved science fiction, and I say that I still love science fiction, but there was a book called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein, which is aimed at teenagers. And one of the main characters was a computer, an AI named Mike, Mycroft Holmes. And I don't know why, but Mycroft Holmes, Mike, really flared my imagination. And I loved the idea of the idea that we could interact with other species of intelligence, whether they were biological aliens, you know, Star Trek kind of stuff, or whether it was a computer. And the idea is, the thing is, you know, we can build the computers potentially. I'm not sure how easy it is to find the aliens, or I'd have gone into astrophysics perhaps. So that kind of fired me up. And that's what I was thinking when I applied to do my PhD, was I wanted a computer that I could speak to like Mike. And it turns out, by the end of the 90s, we were so not close to that that I got frustrated and sort of walked away from it, not expecting that by 2022, Mike was now called ChatGPT, and it was a stunning change, you know. So I think that's what got me into it. And then because I was interested in being able to talk to the computers, then it made me think, well, why can't we talk with other species? And like, what is it that seems to be fundamentally different about us? So I don't know if that's a good or a bad reason. Like, science fiction has inspired my career, but it certainly played a sort of overly large part of my motivation.
I've definitely heard a few kind of techie people and AI people saying a similar thing about science fiction as a source of inspiration when they're younger. So yeah, interesting. I wanted to read something that I read online. It was a question you gave. It was an answer, sorry. An answer, obviously, that you gave to a question in an interview. Because someone asked you, how do you apply behavioral science in your personal life? And I thought it was just so fascinating. You said, if you interact with humans, you use behavioral science all the time. I'm constantly using framing when setting out options for family plans. I use anchoring all the time to set expectations. And social norms are a great one during pub arguments, discussions. When I had pets, I used basic learning theory to train them. When you're in behavioral science, you see it everywhere. Can you say a bit about that? Like, is this something that comes up every day then, and just the way you interact with people in your life?
It does. And I think that's true for everyone, right? I mean, it's funny because sometimes I think it's easy to lose track of the fact that organizations are composed of people. People make the decisions. You know, a lot of these times, governments or companies feel quite faceless. But the reality is, ultimately, whatever the decision is that affects you, someone made it. So I tend to think of the fact that the real influence is other people. And it might be just somebody that you meet, it might be somebody you never meet, whatever. So I always think about that in terms of, well, why do other people behave the way they do? I mean, why doesn't everybody behave like me, right? Because that would be the sort of narcissistic way to see the world. But the reality is that people differ from one another quite a lot. We have a ton of commonalities and common information processing systems, but we have different sort of priorities and different personalities and different things that are important to us. And if you understand that, or if you make an effort to understand that, then a lot of what seems weird in the way other people act is actually sort of plausible. I'll give you an example. My parents are politically active locally in their communities. So my parents are, you know, in their 70s, 80s, and they're really interested in social justice issues. And one of the things that's come up where they live at the moment is, they're in the US, was a local library wants to local politicians want to ban books from the library, particularly like history books about some of the U.S. history that's not very positive for the U.S., right? Because it makes kids feel bad. And it's a particular kind of right of the spectrum Trumpian kind of view of what's the right way to treat your kids. To me, I don't personally follow that ideology. So I find that hard to understand. Like, why would you want to do that? But the reality is, these aren't stupid people. They're not doing things for no reason. They're not trying to be mean or anything. In fact, their intentions are good. They want these our kids to grow up, you know, raised well, proud of their country, aware of traditions and things like that. And I have to like consciously think, well, why? What are the differences here? And one important difference in personality is one of the important traits is sort of the how far you're interested in new experiences versus how much you really value tradition. I tend to be more on the new experiences. Everybody's a mix. It's not either or. But if you were to push it, I tend to be onto the new experience side of things. And one aspect of that is your an interest in equity and fairness. If you're more interested in tradition, then you tend to be more interested in sort of doing things the way they've been done and appreciating why and the values that are important, like family values and where they've come from and the traditions of your country. And then those two things work in opposition. So if I want to understand why somebody wants to ban books, I need to put myself in that headspace. I need to say, well, look, they have a slightly different view of the world, and theirs isn't a crazy view. They're looking at things that I can recognize as important and valuable, but they're weighting them higher than I would weight them. Mm. And if I can do that, I can then have a discussion with somebody about it. I can't, you know, it's easy for me to sit back and just sort of throw stones and say, you know, what you're doing is crazy, and you get this kind of useless argument. It doesn't get anybody anywhere. Whereas if you can understand why people behave differently than you, and you see it as a behavioral science problem, then it also gives you the opportunity to engage in kind of productive conversations. And also it stops you from being angry all the time, right? Like, it's super easy in this world of social media to just sit there on your computer and be angry all the time at people who don't think like you. And to me, I just don't want to live like that. It would make me an unhappy person. So I try to see it slightly more academically and think, okay, well, people are people. Why is somebody acting this way? You've learned a little bit about behavior. Try to apply it rather than just sit here and be a troll. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is some good advice.
It works for me.
Yeah. 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 What do you do to unwind outside of work? Perhaps though you're someone who loves their work so much, it's not like you need to separate yourself so much. But yeah, what do you do in your kind of free time outside of your career?
So the things that I really love outside of work, I'm a big fan of reading novels. I read nonfiction as well, but I love just reading for pleasure. It's a real joy. I love to cook, particularly if I get to barbecue. That's a deep-seated pleasure for me. And I do martial arts. I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu 5-6 days a week, and it's wow. The way I try to stay healthy. Having said that, I hurt my back this morning, so I'm going to be out for a few days. But I love it. It's just fun and it's social and it keeps me moving. And I'm really terrible at just going to the gym. So at least this is something that keeps me going.
Increase the number of people doing BJJ, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. What do you enjoy about that? Why is it beneficial?
Well, one of the things I discovered years ago is I have a weird tendency that I actually do like fighting. I get that that's odd, but to do it in a sort of a safe training environment where yes, you're competing, but no, you're not actually trying to hurt someone else. One of the things I love about it is you have to be in the moment. If somebody's trying to, not in BJJ, but in others, like kick you in the head, then you can't be wandering your head around what's happening at work. You need to be right there and then. Mm. And that's useful for me. Like, I need to get out of worrying about work things and focus on what I'm doing. But I love the social aspects to it. Like, I have a lot of friends who I train with, and they're great people. And we do something healthy rather than necessarily go to the pub, although occasionally we do that too. And it's also like a weird chess match. BJJ in particular, more than some of the other arts I've done, there's just a ludicrous number of moves and positions and ways to do it. And I'm still relatively a novice in the BJJ field. So it's slightly overwhelming, but it's mentally a fascinating challenge. And I love that part of it. And in fact, when somebody's just outdone me. So not just they physically, you know, stronger or whatever, but they've actually tricked me into doing something. And I just think, ah, good on you. I've caught what you did too late. And I want to be able to do that myself. Thank you.
So final question, which I ask every guest, is what do you think it means to live a good life?
I think for me, a good life is being a good person. Like, I want to do something that I think is meaningful, and I really like being a scientist and getting to try to contribute maybe just a little bit to the sort of overall knowledge in the world. I think that's a valuable thing. But of course, I would, because I'm a scientist, right? There's a self-choice aspect to that. I think being a good person to the people in my life, you know, I want to be a good husband, I want to be a good father, I want to be a good friend. So just putting, you know, people who are important to me ahead, wanting to make sure that, they get what they support and love and whatever is, you know, if my kids get more than that in the sense that they get financial help or they get help with their homework or whatever. But I think that, for me, in terms of the business side of it, like being a consultant, is to do that in an ethical way. Like, I think that there's a perception that there's a lot of nonsense neuromarketing out there. I don't want to contribute to that. All I want to be able to do is to give good examples of how these things can be done in an ethical, valid, win-win kind of way that's good for consumers and that's good for businesses. And I think that if I can do that, then that's a valuable contribution as well, even if it's just simply sort of simple demonstrations of those things.
Well, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. It's been really interesting and fascinating to speak to you. So thanks a lot, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe. I really enjoyed it myself.
I should say one last thing as well, which is I realized halfway through the interview that, thanks also for coming on as another Joe dressed the same. So we're kind of matching. This will look quite funny for people.
I did think about that at some point, but I didn't notice it. I think until you got up to talk to them there, I was like, oh, we're wearing the same shirt.
Yeah. First time I wore this on the podcast, so we're clearly aligned on things. Yeah.
I just thought I need a solid shirt because we're filming.
Nice. All right. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Really good.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below, and I hope to see you here again.